to yet another edition of Soma Time. And tonight, we're going to get our little jock straps on, or whatever size you wear, and we'll be discussing the subject of doubt and how athletes are wired a little differently to handle that particular situation. But first, a little summertime music from the Millie Joel Man, just to get us in the mood, and then away we go with a little rant. Alright. We'll just wind that down, Billy. Keep it in your shorts, as it were. Well, I just got off live help with the lovely and talented people over at BTR. And I had some funny files here that I used to like to play, but I got a couple left that I've used in the last 60 days, apparently. Let's see if this one works.
Alright, that's it. He's fired.
Yeah.
Can I talk to you, Val?
No,
yeah,
okay. Please.
I'm back.
That was a coughing fit from a couple of months ago. I think I was in Denver back then. I don't remember. Anyway, BTR has a policy that they apparently didn't tell this host that if you don't use your little files here that you play, the little funny quips, they poof disappear from the server in 60 days. I have it about, I don't know, 30 or 40 up there. I'm down about 5 or 6 now. So, you know, it's going to be an upload weekend for me. And then I'll be playing them. Make sure we get them in the show. This BTR will snuff them out if we don't use them. For, apparently there's limited room in the elevator here at the BTR. So, that aside, you know, we're getting a little distance from 4th of July weekend, but, boy, the celebrities keep dropping, and the news just keeps getting better and better. You know, I'm just shaking it off here. If anyone watched the All-Star game last night, you know, we again, kind of the theme for the show here, dealing with performance under pressure. The president, you know, fresh from dealing with the Russians and dealing with the economy and dealing with the war, took a little white ball out to pitcher's mound in St. Louis, and lollipop went in there to Pujols. But the Fox cameras, which is strange, thinking it's Fox, didn't catch it live. They had the camera off to the side, and they kind of missed where the ball went. And it looked a little, you know, the conspiracy theorists could say, you know, wait a minute. You know, why wouldn't they show this? It's very strange. But anyway, it was interesting to see. And the reaction, of course, was predictable from all corners. But, again, it's this sort of requirement we have as Americans of these rituals that we don't really... It's very strange. It comes out, and everyone has something to say. Everyone has something to say about if he wore the White Sox thing, and he was in jeans, and, you know, the member remembers, you know, probably the finest moment in the Bush presidency was after 9/11 when he came to Yankee Stadium and threw a strike, you know, under all that pressure in the World Series right after 9/11. And ever since then, we sort of judge our presidential machismo by their ability to throw out these first pitches. And if anyone's, you know, go to YouTube and you could see some of the disasters that have gone on with other celebrities in the recent times, Baba Booey being one that comes to mind in the past couple of weeks. Oh, no, the coughing fit. It's back. See if I can play it again. That way it'll stay in the
rotation. All right, that's it. He's fired.
Yeah.
Can I talk to you, Val?
No, yeah,
okay.
Please.
I'm back.
Anyway, yeah, I think it was the guy from the guy that's behind Entourage there, that Marky Mark guy. He kind of lollipop one, basically missed the catcher entirely, and had to throw a second one to complete the ceremony. Anyway, it's one of those things where we look at doubt as fear of the attempt in somatics. So basically, you have a plan, and then right before you execute the plan, you start to see images, or you start to feel tension of not succeeding in the plan, and it inhibits you. And you know, so from my side of the coin in the somatic universe, it has to deal with interference coming from the involuntary part of the nervous system and the voluntary part trying to override that, and of course it cannot. So We're talking about that because athletes have a unique way of dealing with these situations, some of them better than others, and then there's other controversies we want to get into with our guests here in a couple minutes. I didn't look up anything about the swine flu this weekend. I'm sick of it. I am sick of the flu. I'm sick of hearing about it. So if you have any comments or questions about it, be sure to send it over here to me at nakedsoma@gmail.com. I'm not opening the chat room tonight, so screw you all. I'm tired of this. Every time I open the chat room, I lose the switchboard. So you can always pop me an email, and I will try and get those questions on the air before the top of the show at 10 o'clock for our guest. So any other things we have to get out of the way? Let me try to think here. There's a couple of things that were pressing on my brain, but, of course, that little diversion with the help didn't help me. But let's see. We've had a couple of situations come up since the last show. Which, you know, it seems like the gap between shows, by the way, is getting cavernous. I mean, so much goes on in a week. I don't remember doing a show last week. Who was on? Well, was David Goodman on last week? I don't remember anymore. Wow. Yeah, I think he was. Yeah. Wow. It seems like a month ago. Anyway, a lot of news about the brain, a lot of news about behavior, a little clip about the cats that control our behavior with their meowing. So we, you know, there's a research grant that says if you curse, you can your pain threshold goes up. There's so much going on in terms of the way we're trying to understand our humanness, as it were, and then you deal with all the inhumanity that goes on. I mean, there's these hearings that have been going on for the Supreme Court Justice Sotomayor, and all the things that come into play when you deal with looking at things from a somatic perspective. Is this woman is an XO. And if you don't know what an XO is, go to the website, somaspace.org, scroll down to where it says Meet the Four Domains, and read the XO profile there, because she's a 9%er. Her brain design is very rare. And they're doing the same things on the Republican side that they tried to do to Barack Obama, who also has that profile, which means they're trying to get under someone's skin who doesn't have any skin to get under, even though, you know, the Latino thing and all that stuff. Her identity is completely based in a logical platform, and you can't rattle them. It's like trying to rattle Spock. You know, it's not going to happen. So it's like you're watching these people. It's like flies bouncing off the windshield, and nobody seems to sense this. So, you know, it's been an interesting little interplay for me watching them come at them, you know, her with all these different angles, and it's just not happening. And you know, of course, the other controversies have been grinding on, and it seems like a summer of just kind of constant consternation. Like last year, we had a little more of a schedule, so to speak. You know, we had the conventions, and we had before that we had the whole protracted situation with Hillary and our buddy there, Obama, going through the primary season. And now, you know, Sarah Palin, of course, stepping down a year later. The whole thing just seems like it's, I don't want to say it's a soap opera, but it just seems like it's really much ado about nothing. And last year we had, like, a lot more on the line. This year it seems like we're just stirring stuff up just for the sake of stirring it up. So, but anyway, I think our guest is here, and I'm not sure because it's a 386 number, so we'll pop him on and see if it's him. Otherwise, it could just be a salty listener out there in listening land. Some people like to do that as they drive home. But we will take a look. Here's the horn. Let's see if this is our guest. Dr. John, is that you? Hello? Oh, try it again. Dr. John, is that you? Hello? Are you there?
I'm here, but I'm not Dr. John.
Oh, all right. All right, well, you're just listening.
Yeah, that's all.
Okay, we'll let you listen. Hang on. All right. Could be a fan. I don't know. It's, like I said, I never know, so I should probably get the phone numbers. Sometimes people call in from their landlines. They call in from all over the place. So a couple minutes, hopefully, we'll hear Dr. John in a couple minutes call up, and we'll get into some sports psychology, because it's one of those fields where I get a little jealous. You know, raised as a chiropractic puppy, when I came out in the early 90s, sports medicine, as it were, the broad field, was new, and it was exciting, and it was like, you know, this is something that merges the two worlds that I kind of travel in, you know, the clinical world and the world of the sports, and it was like, this is like cool stuff. And I remember being in college and having, like, you know, just having enough information to see what the trainers were doing and kind of figure out, you know, what they were testing when a guy got injured on the field. And sports psychology comes up. And the first time I really had contact with it was the 96 Olympics. And with, you know, they bombed Atlanta, the whole thing. And you were dealing with people that were, you know, that guy, I think there was the two guys going for the decathlon, Dan and the other guy, Dan and Brian, or Dan O'Brien was one guy and it was the other guy. And he screwed up in the tryouts, didn't make it. The sports psychologist went crazy with this. And it's really dealing with failure. It's dealing with setbacks. It's dealing with things that you don't expect. Athletes are, they're finely tuned machines, as it were, physically, but they're very sensitive emotionally because they get all their needs met. Think of those guys, like, you know, what's going on with the Tour de France there. These guys are very sensitive to winning or losing because their whole life depends on it. So we're going to get into that a little now, and especially with the aftermath of Wimbledon, and we're in the preamble to the British Open. So I think this is our guest this time, so we'll go pop him up, and we'll get the horn going again. Take off last night. Is this Dr. John?
This is he. How you doing?
All right. Welcome to the program, Dr. John Murray. This is... I was just getting a little into the history of my experience with sports medicine in general and sports psychology in particular. Were you involved back in the 96 Olympics with any of the athletes that were down in Atlanta?
I was in graduate school in 1996. I was finishing up, actually, my dissertation and doing my internship at Washington State University. So
okay.
The only exposure I had was working with, or I should say, affiliating with some of the people involved in the track and field events, but nothing at the professional level because I wasn't a licensed practitioner.
Okay. Well, I had sort of a bird's eye view because I had some peripheral experience with some of the athletes training up here and being centered in Atlanta, one of the big chiropractic colleges at the time, Life University, was very involved. And it was the first time I ever heard sports psychology uttered out loud. Sports medicine was something that had been evolving for about 10 or 15 years before that. And just as a psychologist, when I don't know how you in particular came across it, but it seems like the field of sports psychology has been opening up, you know, almost the way life coaching opened up, you know, a tick below the clinical levels. So just give us kind of a bird's eye view of how you see sports psychology past, present, and going into the future. What is it? Where did it come from, and how did you get involved in it?
Yeah, great question. Well, first of all, psychology really didn't start until a laboratory in Germany back in the 1880s. That was the first time that anybody ever talked about psychology. Before that, you had philosophy and different kinds of science, but not like medicine. So what happened is, over the years, I mean, there were studies done back in the early 1900s. People looked at how social factors could influence, you know, we're talking about the Tour de France right now. I mean, how social factors influenced cycling speed, and they found that with more people, you had what's called an audience effect. So that the early studies by Triplett, you know, back in the early 1900s, but then there were some people, some icons through the ages. There was a guy in Chicago who worked with some of the, you know, professional teams like the White Sox and the Bears. But really, as a field, I would say that we started to think about sports psychology after the mysterious Russians were doing things to help the Olympic athletes to train, taking them from a very, very young age and helping them beat us in all those Olympics. So I think we started talking about that in the 60s and 70s, and you had the emergence of a subfield of psychology as well as of sports sciences that started to emerge in the 60s and 70s. So you had journals and you had professors at various levels doing things. But as a profession, I think we really started to think about it after the, I believe it was the 84 Olympics, something. It was either the 80 or the 84. And we started to really get into that. Now, I was coaching tennis worldwide, and I was involved in doing weekly workshops in a place in Europe. And I listened to some of the people doing the work at the time, let me some workshops. I read some articles in some of the magazines. And it just made sense for me when I went back to grad school to kind of put it all together and combine my background in psychology, because I had a bachelor's degree from from my college. And I wanted to go back to grad school and become a sports psychologist. So I guess I started out this process back in 1990, going back to grad school, and it's just evolved from there. But no, it's been around for a little while, but I think you're starting to hear more and more of it lately as the media has been sort of the first, let's say, first front, and then after that, some of the sports teams and individual athletes, I think, catch on to it even quicker than the traditional teams like football and baseball. But it's a fun struggle, and I love what I do right now, and I've been doing it for 10 years professionally.
And do you find that people can recognize what that means? When you say sports psychologist, do they perceive you as only working with professional athletes? Because it goes through a spectrum of dealing with, from my sort of distant star view of it, when they call in the sports psychologist, it's usually dealing with someone who's operating from the standpoint of trying to become professional, or they're trying to raise their game up, and they're dealing with obstacles, mental blocks that are interfering with their performance, not necessarily using sports as an outlet like the Weekend Warrior would.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just one aspect of performance would be elite-level performance. Sports psychology mm-hmm. is a big animal. I mean, I like to define it as involving both, helping people improve in exercise and sports settings, at the basic level to enjoy the sport more, but it also can encompass things like high-level elite performance. Now, another aspect to this, another dimension to this would be, I think the typical dichotomy among sports psychologists is that most are trained either in psychology or in sports sciences. So you have this sort of turf war going on between people who are psychologists saying that, hey, if you're a sports scientist, you're really not a psychologist, and then vice versa. You have some of these people from the physical education department saying that, well, you really don't understand athletes. Well, see, what I did in my training is I put both of those together, and I think that's the only way, and I think a lot of people would agree with me, that if you're going to practice sports psychology independently, let's say you're not just doing research or you're not focusing on one part of the, it's kind of hard to deal with a person if you only deal with half their perspective, which is, would involve things like their life, what's going on in their life generally, what kind of mm-hmm. distractions are they having in their personal life or in their professional life that might be interfering with performance, and then also to know about mental coaching, mental training, mental skills training techniques that you can use, like confidence building and focus. So it's a really kind of a imposing challenge to think about becoming a sports psychologist, because you really have to get trained in two disciplines. It's not easy.
Yeah, and again, this is one of those deals where most people have sort of taken on the persona, I guess, in the last 20 years or so, that especially when you're dealing with professional athletes that live in that fishbowl, that there is a tremendous influence of private life and performance on the field or in performance in any job. If you do executive coaching and anything that affects somebody's ability to kind of be able to compartmentalize or to put those things down and focus or take the game on the field into their private lives, as you see a lot with the, especially in the NFL, these guys are in, organized car accidents every week, and they're on so many painkillers and everything, and then all of a sudden they become violent, and everyone goes, ooh, but they're paid to be violent on the field. So how do you deal with that blurred line when you're dealing with someone who's attempting to wrestle with inner demons they might have had since they were a kid, and now all of a sudden it's, they're 20, 25 years old in that range, and everybody's watching them. I always think of Lasting's Millage with the Mets. He had a history in high school, and it followed him. And it seemed like he came into the pros with such a reputation and such a sort of a front load of this guy's trouble that the team never really accepted him. And the first game he was up, he hit a home run, and he was high-fiving the fans, and the veterans didn't like it. It just seems like the person's private life and their identity – off the field, it's much more well known. It's much more in the spotlight than it was maybe even 10 years ago.
Well, you raise a number of really good issues. First of all, yes, personal issues will impact performance dramatically, and that's why you have to understand people generally, because athletes are just people. It's just one class of a person. It just so happens that's their profession. So the issue about the personal side would require you to understand things like psychopathology, depression, anxiety, those things that might be occurring but are not typically occurring. To be honest with you, I think that most athletes are healthier mentally than the general population. Now, the other issue you bring up is living in the fishbowl. Now, it's definitely the case that one of the major distractions, and by the way, I would often say that sports psychology is nothing more than helping people manage distractions. Now, that's an oversimplification, but one of the major distractions would be living in the fishbowl and having to not only perform your sport, but to also undergo the scrutiny of the person sitting on the couch and the media, it can be brutal. So in many ways, you're thrust into this celebrity limelight, and you're having to manage that as well. And to deal with the personal demons in a public way could often be overwhelming. And that begs for the need for more sports psychologists in all different aspects of sports, from Major League Baseball to football. And unfortunately, still, we get a lot of traditional stereotypes, people thinking that if a sports psychologist comes in, he's going to somehow take control of the coach's kingdom. That's not the case at all. We're there to help the coach achieve more success, to be honest with you.
Do you work with coaches as well? Do you work with professional coaches that are dealing with personality issues, and sometimes they're dealing with their own inner demons as well? They have a lot of them, I always think of Tony La Russa, with his mea culpa after his drunk driving last year, and he works for the Cardinals with the big Budweiser sign on the outfield. So do you have any experience working with high level coaches?
Not only do I work with coaches, I mean, I wouldn't say a ton, but some of them do come in. But I also work with referees, professional referees.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
another whole
wow.
aspect that we're not even thinking about. But typically, you get the most common refer would be somebody. Let's say in an individual sport like golf or tennis that comes in to the office or calls me and works with me long distance on the phone. That's the most typical. The coaches, typically the interaction would be helping them help their team to be more effective. For example, I worked 2 years with a Division I basketball team, and I was able to sit on the bench, do a little chalk talk before the game, giving them mental training. And a lot of our discussions my discussions with the coach privately were trying to help tweak performance for the individual players on the team. So it wasn't so much for that particular coach's problems or needs. But let's face it, I mean, a coach faces the same responsibilities a CEO of a major company does, and the scrutiny is often even more intense. So the pressure when you don't have anywhere to go and you're supposed to know everything can be overwhelming. So it's important, I think, for coaches to warm up to the idea as well, and they should know also that it's confidential. I mean, the presumption is always confidentiality here.
Stigma attached to that in professional circles that, they say somebody's soft or somebody's mentally weak or something like that. They got to go to therapy, and it seems like everybody in the stands is in therapy. So within professional athletes, is it still looked as something like, because the rise of people going on the disabled list. There's an article a couple of days ago. There's a laundry list of these players, Dontrell Willis and some of the others, dealing with social phobia and social anxiety disorder. That now that's becoming more prevalent and more more discussed. Is it still sort of a stigma that someone's landed on a couch to get help, or is it okay?
No, it's improving, but it's still a stigma. And I don't think mental illness is more prevalent today. I think it's just more visible today. And it's funny you asked me about that, because in the last week I've done probably four interviews with major publications, some of the top sporting magazines, and talking about the incidence of depression in athletics and so forth. But what is good is that people, when they turn the light on and learn about what's going on, it becomes less mysterious and less scary. I think people need to realize, hey, look, if you're a 340-pound, let's say, offensive lineman, let's say, in football.
Okay.
You need to realize that you break your leg, that's going to be repaired relatively easily, and you're going to be back on the field again. But if you get depressed, that's going to debilitate you much more, and you're going to need some help. So there's no shame. There's no shame in seeking help. And certainly, we know that what's the greatest way to keep anxiety going is to avoid it. In fact, that's what's going on if you have some kind of an anxiety disorder and you try to not talk about it or avoid it, it becomes even more intense. So people need to get that ridiculous stigma that mental illness means you're weak out of their heads. It doesn't mean that at all. Nobody wants to be depressed. Nobody wants to have social phobia. But it's a fact of life. And we used to put these people in chains and tell them that they were possessed by the devil. I mean, how ridiculous is that in the past? So therefore, it's not surprising now in 2009 that people would say there's something wrong with you, or it's a character flaw if you're somehow undergoing some kind of difficulty. Come on, get real, folks. Get real coaches. Get real players. You're tough if you talk. You're a wimp if you don't talk. That's my pitch.
Wow. Well, I mean, you should tune in to FAN every time Pelfrey pitches, because they make a mockery of his situation, you know, with the licking of the hands and everything else, all the little ticks he has on the mound that he's been balking all over the place. I just went and watched his game on Sunday. He balked, and the Mets are up 7-0, and the crowd was around me was merciless about, you know, he's what a head case, and, you know.
Yeah.
And it just seems like that is much more it's much more, I guess, it, you know, you can't really relate to blowing out your knee or separating your shoulder as much unless you've been an athlete or tried to compete. But you can relate to anxiety. You can relate to the butterflies in the stomach. You can relate to getting down on yourself. So when people see that in their athletes, which they, and again, to me, the fans are much, much more harsh on the players than they used to be for a variety of reasons. But it just seems like that aspect of dealing with failure, and I had the opportunity this morning to watch the HBO special about Shot Heard Around the World with Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca.
Mm-hmm.
And here's two athletes, you know, in a completely different era, you know, 50, 60 years ago, whatever it was, and the way that they dealt with it in the both publicly and privately is to me, it's remarkable that these two men lived through this in the way that they did. And it just seems to me like that aspect of being a professional or an athlete or whatever has sort of gotten to be sort of passe, and it's more about, you know, dealing with failure. Now, we're only 20 years or so removed from Donnie Moore, you know, committing suicide after letting up the home run in the ALCS that year that the Mets beat the Red Sox. And, you know, you just see more and more, to me, athletes kind of crashing and burning like celebrities.
Yeah, I mean, the pressure has to be enormous. Now, although I would say that the stress is not what causes suicide. I mean, when somebody's severely depressed or they have bipolar disorder, that's really the cause of suicide, much more than an environmental trigger, but there are triggers. But interesting about the comment about the past and how they dealt with it differently in the past. I think we've learned a lot, and I think we need to continue learning about what's going on and exposing these problems for what they are. They're problems that have solutions, and you might need medication, you might need psychotherapy, you might need just some mental skills coaching. But, you know, even beyond the mental illness, one of these days I'm going to help some coach win a Super Bowl, and that's going to happen because they're going to buy into this idea of tweaking performance individually as well as a team.
Who do you see out there in coaching? Because I always think of the USC coach. His name is running around in my head right now. I can't remember his name.
Right, but with the Patriots before, yes, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah, and he's been someone who's constantly been preaching about, you know, sort of the Zen aspect, kind of like, you know, the cross town over there with the basketball team, that there is this inner level of clarity that we can get to, and you just see a lot of the old school coaches. I mean, you're down there in Florida, you know, Parcells, with that, you know, it doesn't really try to relate to the player on that level and get into the icky sticky stuff. They deal with roles and they deal with hierarchy and they deal with top down way of organization. So, do you see a change going on fundamentally in the coaching ranks where it used to be much more of a militaristic mindset? Now it's more sort of a back and forth interactive type of a thing?
Well, that's a really good question. I think in some ways nothing has changed and everything has changed. I think, you know, if you look back to the early years of Tom Landry and Don Shula, that wasn't even earlier, that was just 34 years ago, they were doing psychological testing and they were, you know, getting into the individual psychologies of
right.
players. I think what's changed is with the emergence of the profession, you have some good people that can help in a much more scientific or, let's say, professional way with 10 years of training and lots of experience. And so I don't think that psychology has ever been, I mean, even like I alluded to earlier, the Bears using somebody back in the 20s, I mean, it's always been around. Coaches are master psychologists in many ways, but they're not professionals. And so I think it's just, I don't think that you have to be in one particular style. I mean, some coaches might be a little bit more touchy-feely. Others might be more hierarchical, like Bill Parcells, but I'm certainly not about to criticize Bill Parcells for his psychological ability or his insight, because he's brilliant. Whatever he's done has been amazing at all levels. So I don't even know the guy, but I'm going to guess that he's doing some major psychology in terms of just intuitively, you know, knowing what's going on, how the players are ticking, and how to manage them best. So I guess what I'm trying to resist is
this, that innate to someone like him? Because he had no formal training. It's something that, you know, he's been a coach since he was, you know, in his 20s, and it's just something that to learn behavior.
Yeah.
He just learns how to read people.
I don't know. I mean, all great coaches, you know, they're teachers. I mean, I think Bill Walsh being a great person that studied the game, looked at Muhammad Ali, and was trying to get his players quicker to the punch and just professionalism, just dealing with the individual in a different way. There's a lot of things that I think coaches have for years borrowed from the field of psychology, which is nothing but the study of human behavior and how we can maximize that in this particular case. So I think that all coaches are teachers. Some are better than others. Obviously, there's a pecking order. There's always going to be somebody that wins, somebody that loses. What I'm promoting is not to change a coach's style. I mean, some might be more out of the Parcells' way of dealing with things, and others might have a little bit different approach. But what I'm saying is that, hey, look, we got a profession, and why aren't we tapping into it? There are great professionals out there. Instead, what they'll often do, in my opinion, erroneously, is to bring in a celebrity to give a talk before a game. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about a speech. I'm not talking about a workshop. I'm talking about taking the approach that at the beginning of the mini camps, you start to get to know the players, you have office hours, you meet them, you develop mental skills profiles on all the players, and then you have not only the ability to work one-on-one and be able to anticipate problems before they occur, you know, so that we can prevent some of these problems that occur, and also just help motivate that person and know how they're operating, but also deal on the team level, because there's a team confidence, a team focus, a team energy that needs to be managed as well. And
well,
I don't
wait, before we go any further, because people might just be hearing this word mental skills and they're kind of at the stop point.
Okay.
Well, give me a couple of examples of mental skills that you would want to assess somebody.
Well, when I go over to Wimbledon every year, I do the eight skills, mental skills. There are things like focus. Focus is probably the most important mental skill. And one of the problems is you'll hear coaches often, I've seen this on NFL practice field, yelling at the players to focus. Now, nothing could be more ridiculous than that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the greatest way to distract somebody is yell them and tell them to focus. I mean, when I teach focus, I'm talking about getting excited in the moment so much that you're not even aware of it. I mean, being totally absorbed in what you're doing so that you're loving it so much that you're not even having to say focus. But there's a number of these skills. Look, I'll give you some others. Passion, resilience, discipline, confidence, goal setting, using of imagery, balancing energy levels or energy control, emotional control, that kind of thing. And so I look at the world from those subtle but not to be overlooked mental skills that a lot of people, you know, play lip service with, or the media talks about it a lot. They talk about who is confident, who is not confident. Well, I mean, I think that's given lip service too in training. I mean, typically coaches don't take the time out to really understand a player's level of confidence and the subtleties involved in that. And then the second thing would be to train them so they become confident. And it takes a long time. I mean, you have to work on it for week, you know, week after week after week to really get somebody to the right place. You can't just say do this, or you could read a book. There would be no need for professionals if knowledge alone were behavioral change. We all know how bad it is to smoke, but people still smoke. I just got back from Europe. I went over to Stockholm, Sweden, and London for my annual, you know, sports psychology workshops. People are smoking up a storm there. I mean, more than we are in the States, which is interesting. But the point is that the people still kill themselves. It's the number one behavioral cause of death, and they still do it. So the point is knowledge
it's addiction, and you're dealing with things that get past, you know, the psychological filters early on, and they anchor themselves. So, again, and this is another thing with athletes, especially dealing with ones that I always think of Brett Favre as the textbook case, of dealing with the addiction of being an athlete and not knowing when to retire or how to exit the game. Do you deal with a lot of depression, a lot of transition with athletes that, you know, maybe they don't exit the field on their own terms, or maybe they don't exit the field at an age where they can go into retirement successfully? You know, Lenny Dykstra last week filed for bankruptcy. You know, he's had ups and downs the last 3 or 4 years too, as well, dealing with his personal life. So, how much of the post-athletic field do you have an ecology for sports psychology with these athletes after their careers are over?
Well, yeah, that's a huge area. That's another one of those chapters in that, you know, 25-chapter book on sports psychology would be dealing with retirement issues. No question involved about that at all.
Because injury is one thing, but when it's over, especially when it's over suddenly, I would imagine it's a little bit like having a lot of phantom pain, which I think Brett Favre goes through pretty much every spring, and he finds another team to bring him back. And I just, you know, Pedro Martinez, case in point, you know, just signed him with the Phillies. today, and talking about feeling rejected, you know, by the Mets. You know, rejected for $50 million. I don't know, but it's these issues again. I kind of circle back to some of the forefathers in dealing with social identity. Think of Marino with psychodrama and the early cybernetics people, and even some of the modern guys like Dan Siegel and Alan Shore and Dan Goldman that deal with this social intelligence to know yourself and know what your strengths are, and know what your assets are in a given situation. It seems like a lot of sports psychology or a lot of the interventions that go on focus on overcoming weakness and overcoming pitfalls. Is there more of does positive psychology and sports psychology have an overlap, or is it much more about dealing with preparation and dealing with sort of reappraisal and going into a situation with your eyes wide open and sort of, like I said, anticipating and navigating through failure rather than trying to avoid it and whitewash it?
Well, you've raised a number of good issues again. And just to make a quick comment, our athletes, I heard this quote a couple of weeks ago, and I think it's great. I can't remember where I heard it, but our athletes are the only people that we ask to die twice, the first time being the retirement. So that's a very interesting thought.
Well, they make it akin to death. Who said that?
I'm not sure where I heard that, but I loved it. And I said, I'm going to use it on the phone with Mark when Mark calls me.
Okay, well, yeah, because it happens to performers as well. I deal a lot with musicians and artists and stuff, and that transition. I mean, middle age is no picnic for any of us, but athletes who have been, you know, basically adored for, you know, 2/3 of their life experience suddenly don't matter. That's a tough one, and it is a death, I guess. You can make it akin to a death, or it's a major transition for them. So,
first of all, to get to that level in any sport, you have to be a complete freak. I mean, anybody that's achieved at the professional sports level has had to have been the best in their neighborhood, the best in their city, best in their county, best in their state, best in their country, and one of the best in the world. And that's an extremely rarefied air. And so you've been adored, you've been supported, you've been congratulated your whole life. Your whole mission, your whole purpose in life has been to do what you're doing. And so now for that to all end, how is it possible to cope with that? So I think that's one area that we as sports psychologists can get in and help athletes anticipate, you know, by having that open communication with the athlete, even though you're really never going to be prepared for it when the time comes, at least you can start. Now, the other thing you talked about was the approach to working with athletes, whether it should reflect more of a positive psychology approach or facing it directly. I think all of that is true. I think it's a very positive approach. I overall view it as taking a person who's already a high-level performer and helping them become even more effective, more successful, more, I call it high-performance psychology. So it's positive psychology on steroids. You know, it's to help you not only become positive but to become great. And there's a risk involved in that, but you have to temper that with the, like, issues like retirement. It's going to end at some point, but there's a lot of things you can do with this field, and it, you know, you think about it, it's just a specialty within psychology, dealing with the athlete and the athlete's particular needs and being able to address those needs. And sometimes it's a little bit unconventional. Sometimes you'll meet your athlete out on the field or in a group. You don't normally do that in typical psychotherapy, and that's actually what I love about the field, is that you get to work with a lot of people and you get to see the results, you get to see what they're doing. So
Would you typically work? Would you work with an athlete over the course of one season, or you say that sometimes years?
Well, it depends. I mean, some I've worked with for 8 years. Others will come in for a package of 20 sessions or 10 sessions, and that's the end of it, and might get a call from them a year later. Maybe never hear from them again. But the point, it all depends on the person. What I do is I try to, first of all, assess what they need, do a full assessment, two-hour process where we do the report and find out what's going on and what they need, why they're coming in. Typically, they're coming in because they're not performing well or there's some kind of problem. But what I'm trying to do is help people realize that just the same way that we take nutrition seriously, we take weight, you know, strength training seriously, this is just another aspect of training. It's just another part of becoming the best you can be. It's not just for people with problems.
It just seems like it's just something that's become much more accessible in the last maybe 10 or 15 years, where before teams would refuse, they would look at that stuff as voodoo, or as you say, a threat to their authority, And now you have the other animal, which is you know, again, I got Bill Parcells on the brain today. He used to say there were three enemies. There's the opponent across the field. There's the enemy within, dissension within the team, and then the media as the third enemy. And he, you know, that's why he was always there. I'm the only one to talk to the press, because he didn't think these guys were mentally equipped to handle the gymnastics that the press will go to get a guy to say something that becomes, you know, good copy. Mm-hmm. And now you're dealing with situations like with tainted success, where people have achieved on this massive scale on these high levels, and then it's the fall from grace. It's the Barry Bonds. It's the A-Rod. It's the Manny having to deal with tarnished reputations and basically having their success dismissed. And you know, the subject again came up with talking about Pete Rose, you know, the commissioner coming out of the All-Star game was – he's, you know, just now saying, oh, maybe I'll, you know, one of my things before I leave is I'll see if I can get Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame. There's an immortality when you deal with sports, especially pro sports, because these moments are replayed, and you just think about, you know, what does a Bill Buckner do when he's in his 70s, you know, when he's seen this damn Mookie ball go through his legs, you know, 10,000 mm-hmm. times.
Yeah.
You know, it just seems like there's tainted success, and then there's sort of protracted failure for some of these athletes that they have to live with their careers being judged from every angle because it's good copy and the books come out and there's the entire you know, memorabilia industry and all the card shows and stuff like that. So it just seems like their iconic life runs parallel to their real life, and then
yeah.
and then these guys just I just see them really struggling with that. And do you guys, As a field, I mean, as the era of steroids has become, you know, more prevalent, dealing with these guys psychologically as they get outed, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
Has that become an issue?
No doubt about it. I just wrote an article about Michael Jackson's death. I mean, this isn't sports.
Oh, really?
But it was something, I forget the title, but it was something like fame can kill you. Fame is very dangerous. I mean, we somehow in our society, the media, and we're media right now, we're a form of media right now, you know, talking to people, hopefully somebody's listening. And
yeah, there's one guy
and
well, there,
maybe agreeing or disagreeing.
Code, he's hanging in there.
That's cool. Hey guy, whatever, or girl.
Yeah, I don't know where he was from, but he was your fan, not mine.
Okay,
yeah.
But here's the deal. I think that we love to pick people up and put them up, exalt them to these ethereal status, but it's ridiculous. I mean, these are human beings. They have faults and weaknesses just like everybody else, even
mm-hmm.
if they're rich. So there's almost a risk in being famous. So, and I think, you know, when you really get down to the core of the person, it's just a person like you and I walking on the street. I mean, it's just a person that tends to have better skills in their particular profession, and that's all. But we do have this mythical need to have heroes, and this hero worshiping can be horrible when the hero falls. And then, you know, I think I don't really know Michael Jackson, but I know somebody who knew him very well. I know one of his best friends very well. And he talks about how, you know, the pressure and the stress of once the cheers stopped was very tough to deal with. So that, I'm not going to say that caused him to use drugs illicitly, but it probably did. You know, it was a factor involved in that. So yes, it's a huge issue. I think stop trying to be perfect, everybody. I mean, we don't need heroes to be. And if you're a great athlete out there listening to the show, you know, you don't have to live to that standard of being some kind of a person on a golden chariot, you know, helping out everybody. I mean, be a person.
The image is so important to these guys. Look at what LeBron James does to protect and you know, sort of secure the brand. And then you look at someone like Kobe, who went through, you know, his big, you know, the trial in Colorado and everything, and look at what happened to his reputation, and yet he had to continue to press on and play through, you know,
mm-hmm.
while he was going through a trial or he was going through whatever was going on within his marriage and all the mishmash with Shaq, and it just seems like there's a lot of personality wars that go on outside the game that bleed into the actual competition on the field, and you end up with these personal rivalries and cities get involved in it, and
right.
it just, you know, it happens on NCAA levels all the time within different factions of the different conferences in basketball. There's just a tendency, I think, to have a lot of that residue just kind of be used as fodder from the media to kind of bait people into these things.
Yeah, it's true. And I think most people live in live, you know, looking up to their fan, as a fan looking up to their heroes, and, you know, rather than getting on with their own life and having a successful life and doing what they do. I think we love that aspect. We love to be a fan. There's good things about being a fan too, but I think the athlete needs to be prepared to deal with the attention and the scrutiny mm-hmm. and the criticism, and not let that become his or her self-identity, and be careful about that. And that's, again, another area where we as different, you know, helping professionals can get in there and hopefully have an impact. Fame's a very, very dangerous thing.
Well, just to see as an aside here, because sports has become sort of a way of life in this culture. Like, you see that we've made competitions at just about everything.
Yeah.
And with American Idol and the way people, you know, the public eye is just pouring in on these you know, budding stars. And they always bring in the first couple of shows. They show the people have no shot, and it's just they want to get on TV. That's their goal.
Mm-hmm.
And I just see the other side of it, the one that's really, really has their whole heart and soul in this thing, and, you know, Simon rips them up or whatever. Are you starting to get calls from people that are you know, just like you have the Olympic wannabes that are training, the people that want to come through the ranks and be musicians and be pop, you know, pop culture icons, looking for sports psychology as a tool to deal with their performance world?
That's happening. I've had a couple calls like that. I'm thinking about music. I haven't had too many for music, but I had mm-hmm. one female broadcaster. I think she was with one of the major networks that was dealing with some of the issues of being scrutinized. I've had lots of local, like, you know, broadcasters in big cities across the states, that kind of thing.
I'm sure. Yeah, talk show hosts must deal with it a lot. I don't know if Sid Rosenberg's been calling you, but he's had a rough couple of months, too.
Well, the way I define this is, you know, high-performance psychology. So and I guess the stakes are raised when mm-hmm. you're perceiving possible, you know, pressure from the scrutiny of millions. And so whatever you're doing, you know, typically it's athletes, but it's definitely appropriate for business executives that are dealing with stress, performing artists, musicians.
Almost everybody's in the public eye these days because of the fact that, look at us, we're on the internet here.
Well, it's, you know what, after 9/11, here's how I see the world. After 9/11, there's no more secrets. We all live in a fishbowl. And so we Twitter and tweet our lives away. And that's,
right.
You know, if you got lemons, you might as well make lemonade. That's my view. So anybody that tunes into my Twitter thing, I have fun with that. And I'm a sports psychologist trying to help people, and it's part of my marketing effort too, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
To try to get people more involved in this and to understand the benefits of this. And so we just turn it around. People are all, you know, they're all the blog sites now. They all have their websites. I think in many ways we're all on stage today.
And they can hook up on that on johnfmurray.com to follow you on Twitter. Just go over there and click
through. Yeah, I haven't put the Twitter link up there yet. It's Palm Beach Dr. John. Palm Beach, DrJohn is my Twitter identification. You can probably just look up sports psychologist and John F. Murray or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also heavily involved in Facebook, but the website is John F. Murray, J-O-H-N, F as in Frank, MURRAY.com.
Hey, one of the things I'm tapping into a lot lately is comedians.
Really?
Dealing with their somatic demons on my side because, again, it's performance art. You're dealing with body language. You're dealing with nonverbal communication skills, which gets into my field. It's another one of those worlds where you're dealing with very quick and sometimes very harsh judgment going both directions, dealing with hecklers, dealing with management, dealing with, you know, other comedians competing and stealing your material, and it's a very carnivorous field. And they are buddying up to athletes more, much the way musicians used to. So I'm seeing a blend here of these lines being drawn where you're finding all these fields that are, quote-unquote, on the performance level and dealing with the humanity of it and the inhumanity of it and the fact that a lot of these guys are not coming through with a lot of education, a lot of experience. They're in their 20s. Mm-hmm. They don't even have adult brains yet. As I try to remind some of these guys that are 21, 22, 23 years old, like Jabba Chamberlain is on a spit up here. They just keep turning him around like he's like, you know, like it's a pig roast.
Mm-hmm.
And he's 23 years old. His mother's a full-blown alcoholic. He gets arrested last summer for drunk driving in Nebraska, which is hard to believe that even happens. he's like the only car on the road. And he's been dealing with just constant judgment from Yankee fans the last year and a half. And he's coming off of an injury. And you know, you got a team that's basically a $200 million payroll. And he's the fifth starter on the team. And it just seems like there's no preparation, there's no filter between the Yankee management and the way that they put this kid in front of the media to be basically flambéed. And he's literally, you could see he's getting more irritated, and he's not dealing with it as well as maybe if he had support for that. And I deal a lot with brain design, and knowing what somebody is wired to be from development, and then you look how the behaviors overlap on top of that. I just look at, you know, humor is one of those things where, especially when you're dealing with injury and illness and setbacks and failure, if they can learn, especially in a sport like baseball, where, you know, it's 70% failure and you're in the Hall of Fame, it just seems like if they understood that they're in a signal-to-noise type environment, it's not just about win or lose, it's about ratios. And you know, all the statistician guys, they love to cough up all these stats, but when you're dealing with art, when you're dealing with things that get judged on aesthetics, and like I always think of in sports, like Olympic sports, like figure skating and things like that, where they could do something and practice it 1,000 times, and they're off a tick the day of the performance, and it's the difference between going to oblivion and going to a medal stand.
No doubt.
How do you prepare somebody to face that type of a diamond cutter?
Well, enter the field of sports psychology. What? I like your comments about the comedians. I think
they're all over the place.
They've got to be number one, some of the most intelligent people on the planet to be able to survive in that predatory environment. And you're right. I have an athlete. I'm not going to say his name, but if he's listening, he knows who he is. He's been number three in the world as a bowler, and he loves to go to these comedy clubs around New York. It's one of his favorite pastimes is to go to the comedy clubs. And, yeah, I mean, humor is a definite coping tool as well, to be able to look at the light side of things. And so I think in baseball, definitely, you know, a sport of failure. And you have to what's nice about what we do in our field is I'm not asking, let's say you come to me and you want to improve your batting percentage. I'm not going to ask you to do anything that's not completely under your control, because what we're focusing on and what we're emphasizing is the focus on process and performance, not winning and losing, not outcome. And I think that's where people get into that trap. It's ironic that to be able to win, you almost have to not think about winning. It's a major distraction. We all want to win. That's natural. But if you think about winning too much, you're going to be placing too much negative pressure on yourself. So, again, we only control what we can control, and we try to, you know, perform the best possible performance we can. I'm not saying that to be less responsible. You are, in fact, you're more responsible. It's a heavy burden to have to work hard and get ready for performance and then give it your all. But you've got to be on autopilot. As you said, just one little mistake is going to mess up the performance, and a lot
sometimes
of times
years of preparation, and it's gone in a couple of seconds. Yeah.
Because of anxiety. Most of the time, it typically, you know, you've got a part of your brain that sends signals down to your muscles. That's all you need. You don't need to be feeling like you're being attacked by a saber-toothed, you know, tiger when you're getting ready to go do a gymnastics performance. But that's what happens. People have the adrenaline dump or the fight or flight response, or even if it's a mild form of anxiety, they disrupt their smooth muscle coordination by engaging in this absurd. And sometimes it happens at an automatic level. So this is my point, is when I'm working with somebody, it's not all conscious talking that helps them. It's the training. It's the imagery sessions. It's the practice with a purpose that makes the skill automatic, that makes the mental skill automatic. That's what helps somebody.
And someone told me at a workshop, three, 4 months ago, I was out in Denver, that they liken sports psychology to a Western form of martial arts. Where you're dealing with, you know, both activity on the outside and being centered on the inside, and coupling those two things into an expression, and on a consistent basis, so that they can get back to that rhythm. It's like, you know, the black belt and the white belt that's just starting. It's the same basic movements that they're trying to perfect over time, but the focus, the centeredness, is equal. The intensity varies. Yeah.
You know, back if you look at, you know, when I was first involved in. And after college, I picked up a tennis racket for about 6 years and traveled the world with it.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a book that came out in 1974. That's why that was when I was not even in high school. But it was called The Inner Game. It's
Inner Game of Tennis.
And I would say that's the Eastern, even though it was written by a Westerner, ironically, but it's an Eastern approach. It's basically get out of your own way. You know, focus on the middle way or the Zen way. Well, so what I tried to do when I came along after, you know, Brad Gilbert then wrote a great book called Winning Ugly, where he talks about the actual player's experience, player's perspective of how to win the mental game. I came along in 99? I think it was 99 or 2000. I wrote Smart Tennis. So what I tried to do is stand on the shoulders of people like Gilbert and Tim Galloway's Inner Game and do something that combined the West with the East. So I have the same principles of staying completely in the middle, staying focused being in the zone. But at the same time, what we've done in the West is we've made things explicit. Our science is phenomenal. We've really learned a lot. There's been a tremendous amount of literature that often goes untapped. It's sitting in dark corners of libraries across these academic institutions all over America, hundreds of them. And so what I've tried to do is pull from those research lessons and apply not only the simplistic, basic message of the East with the incredible knowledge we have in the West and put those two together, and I think that's what I tried to do, at least in Smart Tennis when I wrote that.
And the tennis players, I mean, you're fresh from Wimbledon, and there was so much drama there between the Williams sisters again facing off and almost a distaste from the media here anyway. Here they are playing again, and the perception is that not that it's a canned match, but it's not as tasty as having them play someone that's opposite them, and not just make it something, you know, the sisters again, all they are. And then on the other side, Federer dealing with his immortality issues, you know, with winning the majors, and poor Roger there, and then dealing with the enemy within and the enemy without, with Nadal not being there, and then having a guy that I can't remember the record he had against Roddick going into the final. It was like 15-1 or something insane, and Andy playing basically the match of his life. And again, it goes for naught. So, from a perspective of someone who's in the Wimbledon community, knows that ethos there, you being, you know, kind of like feet on the ground, was the sympathy or was the crowd sentiment more towards Andy, basically trying to, you know, to be, you know, the David and Goliath kind of situation, or was it more toward give Federer his just due here?
I think when it was all said and done, I think the respect for Federer was enormous. You can never predict a British crowd, first of all. They're a very interesting. If anybody out there in Britain is listening, coming to my workshop, you're probably laughing right now, probably smiling. They're a different type of person. But obviously the respect was there for Roger, even though it seemed subdued a little bit. It seemed a little subdued. Andy gave a great performance. It was a near miss. But what Roger did, down 15-40 on his serve in that tiebreak, to come back from that and, you know, to basically just look that in the face and just keep on playing, showed that he's like a Tiger Woods. And that was the hardest, you know, probably the hardest win of his career. So, I mean, you have to give him a lot of credit for that. As far as the fans go, it's hard to predict the British.
It's a different culture. But, I mean, just comparing, around the same time, we had the U.S. Open here going on in Long Island here, and Phil Mickelson's run, you know, dealing with first his wife and then his mother's cancer, and Tiger Woods coming back from his knee injury a couple of years ago. He was around here during the Open when his father died. These individual sports seem to illuminate, you know, a lot of the personal life issues, where the team sports, you know, it doesn't come up as much unless it's Brett Favre playing on the night, after his father died or something like that. So how do you approach a team sport player versus an individual sport player who's dealing with off the field issues and you know, trying to overcome them while they're under the scrutiny of playing in a championship type situation?
Is it
easier
exactly
for the team
the
guy?
It just depends on what that person comes in with. And what's so fun about my work is that I've never met two people the same. I mean, every time I do an evaluation, even though there's similar themes that crop up, one thing I've learned, a respect I've gotten, is that what you see is not what you get. In other words, you see somebody in the media and you have a certain perception of how they are. When you actually meet them as a person, they're totally different. So that's one thing I've learned in being fortunate enough to work with some number of celebrities in sports, is that they're not the same as what you're seeing. So there's a personal reality, and there's a...
Is that good or bad, by the way?
What's that?
Is that good or bad that maybe you have a perception that somebody's kind of, like a Randy Johnson has a perception of being kind of a tough guy?
Well, it can
guy.
Be both. It can be... The public can be making somebody out to be a great person when they're really kind of a... I'm not going to use the word.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it can be a really great person that's trying to present an image for marketing purposes or just to keep people off kilt, you know, off a little bit.
Yeah, A-Rod's looked at as being very disingenuous, for example, and the press never, that's why all those interviews, you know, he did in the spring, one sunk him more, because he kept basically parsing the truth. And then you contrast that with Roger Clemens shouting from the mountaintops last year, and look at his credibility going right down the mountainside. So it just seems like their personalities, as much as they try to, I don't know, hide them from themselves or hide them from the public, they seem to squeak out one way or the other, and you as the sports psychologist gets to know them, you know, sort of behind the scenes,
right.
So you see a little more raw view of them.
Well, the media has a lot of power, and I think they determine what they're going to present many times.
Right, it's a big filter, yeah.
It's oftentimes very unfair. And that's often their complaint. But it's a double-edged sword. They're also benefiting greatly by having that exposure and by having, you know, 300,000 people following them on Twitter.
Is Twitter, you think, is there going to be like a Twitter rehab at some point for people?
Probably. People said it died out, but I don't think it's going to die out. If you're listening to Twitter, you guys are pretty good. It's pretty impressive.
No, Lance Armstrong's still Twittering in his sleep, the poor guy. He can't. I mean, I know when this guy's good is brushing his teeth and which hand he's holding the toothbrush.
That's funny.
Like he's always, you know,
I do it, too. I went to Las Vegas this past weekend for the UFC 100, and I was Twittering the whole way through it. It was amazing. It was fun.
Yeah, that was another thing. This Ultimate Fighting has really taken off. In first, it was completely underground. It was even below wrestling. And now it seems like it's gotten to the point where it's become a legitimate, you know, pay attention sport, because, of course, the more eyeballs, the more money, the more interest. Do you see that sport, which has a lot of, I mean, what's this, you could throw, how many social issues can you throw in the basket with that sport? I mean, we're two steps below rollerball here, you know.
No, it's brutal. I've been to a few events, and working, again, as a professional, what I do, let me be honest. I initially did not like the sport. I thought it was too violent. Okay, that was my initial feeling. But then working professionally, you have to be willing to withhold your own judgment about things. In other words, you have to work with many different kinds of people, and the goal is to help them be the best they can be. Now, I think what's happened with the sport since about 2000 is they've changed the rules a little bit, made it a little bit safer, and the refereeing has improved. So I think it's become more palatable overall. I think it's got some work to do, though. I don't like the idea of somebody, you know, flying from the top all the way down with a punch into somebody's face and crushing their, you know, skull. I don't think that's smart. I think they need to clean it up a little bit. But I think it's a tremendous, from a purely athletic perspective, nothing could be better. Nothing could be more interesting than to say, hey, use all the martial arts and do whatever you can to try to win. I mean, it's an amazing violent chess match.
Yeah, it's very visceral. And the thing is that... I find it being, you know, very much like Twitter. Twitter's very visceral, too, and people don't even think about it. And they look at how many problems have resulted on Facebook from people posting things they think are basically not being seen. And this is another fascinating area of sports psychology, dealing with the fact that the allure of sex, violence, success, you know, fame, all these things are powerful carrots that draw people in. But there's also very, very powerful sticks and consequences when you step over those lines. And how much do you see, I mean, you talked before about the female sports reporter, how much do you see the line being crossed and blurred and all those, you know, sort of hands on the stove type phenomenon happening where there are consequences for the athletes and it's only after the fact, it's almost like, you know, after the drunk driving, they go to psychology. Do you see any of these guys being proactive in anticipating this, or it always comes after they've sort of hit the proverbial wall?
No. Typically, they start to sense there's something that could go dramatically wrong, and they seek help. And I see that
really. Okay.
There might be a sense that, you know, something's getting out of control, and I need some help. It shows up in stress. I mean, people don't do well when they're stressed, when there's too much stress on them. So they'll come in and try to alleviate some of that. And a lot of times, it's just problem solving. It's don't do this or do this or whatever. So being being smart in your decisions is something to really look at. And of course, when you're talking about youth and you're talking about hormones and you're talking about the excitement and the glamour of being in the spotlight, it raises the stakes. So
and the bulletproof perception, because I mean,
yeah.
You know, there's also that aura of, you know, we just had that case, you know, where the guy got 24 days in jail when he Dante Stallworth, you know, killed a guy in Florida and paid off the family and got like a month in jail, and the public outcry about that. So there's still a sense that athletes get such a break and such a sort of a ride here, and then you deal with the way they get disposed of and the way they get sort of like, you know, put down as sort
right.
of used up batteries when they're no longer of service to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So I get, like you say, and it is a funhouse mirror. It is sort of a double-edged sword,
mm-hmm.
and I just don't know if the denial factor is something that athletes can anticipate, because they are given, you know, such outpouring of to me sort of phony support and love. When they're good for you, they're good for you, and then when they're not, they just get,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of the plug gets pulled and the rug gets pulled out from under them, and you see a lot of these guys' lives deteriorate as a result. So if they can get sports psychology into the athlete's DNA, so to speak, when they're coming through the ranks, when they,
mm-hmm.
because it goes all the way down. I mean, I don't know how far down sports psychology goes for you, but on the local level, you see it with the travel leagues. You see it with, you know, with the fighting among the families and the umpires, you know, at the Little League games. With this is the, some for some families, especially, you know, you talk about Tiger Woods, but, you know, some of these families, that's their only way that they're going to get out of situations they're in. They hitch themselves to their kid, much like, you know, Jabba Chamberlain's father did with him and the Williams sisters and on. So do you see it becoming just like almost like a sort of a societal, you know, just like it is with, you know, with American Idol and all the other fields, where you, if you show talent early, you know, hockey, Canada, they still have skates in these kids when they're two, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is that something that is acculturated and people can sort of modulate this if they have that centeredness? Or do you think it's something, because we're in a society where, you know, achievement is awarded and exploited and carried through, where we just have to kind of like, you know, once they get up on that pinnacle, we have to just keep them on the tightrope as long as we can?
Wow, you again raise a number of issues there.
Yeah, I know.
there's a catch-22 involved, and that is you have to have the awareness of the benefit of doing this work to be able to pull the trigger and use it, and oftentimes it comes too late. So I always say that parents are my best friend, because that's where I get most of my referrals are from parents of high-achieving junior athletes, to be honest with you. Any sport,
mm-hmm.
And the parents will know what's they'll sense that their kids need help. They'll know when there's a problem or when they want to have better preparation for whatever's happening. It is a tightrope, and you are going to be subject when you live in the public eye to whatever the public decides. And so you have to be willing to, if you're going to go into that arena, you're going to have to accept that that's going to be part of the challenges. How do you deal with that? You deal with that hopefully in advance. You hopefully get the right people around you and get a team and a support staff, and you listen to them and you listen to your family and friends. And I think that's why there's sort of a repugnance to the you know, the fan oftentimes in top athletes. They don't like the fan a lot of times. They don't like the media a lot of times because of that. It's sort of an us against them thing. Not always the case, but again, the double-edged sword is that it gives them the money, it gives them the fame, it gives them what they have as a career, but it can also be very very difficult to deal with, and it needs to be, in my opinion, dealt with early, early, early.
Yeah, because it gets suppressed very easily, and you end up with situations like the Steve McNair case, where he was living, you know, pretty much a double life. And again, not unusual for athletes to have, you know, multiple relationships and, you know, go on the golfing trips with their friends and have the wives just sort of understand that this is the situation and, you know, and have this, you know, community kind of persona. And he apparently was a very philanthropic guy, took
mm-hmm.
care of his family, did all the right things, so to speak, and then look at the way he's going to be remembered despite
yeah.
living this parallel universe, you know, but that was supposedly, you know, very much apple pie, and over here we find something else out about him. And you know, and you think of the retired athletes like Lawrence Taylor, who, you know, can, or Darryl Strawberry, who can go all the way over the edge, down into Dante's Inferno, come out with a souvenir, and be sort of on a victory tour because they survived it.
Yeah.
And come back. So the athletes, like I said, they do apparently die twice, but they're also reincarnated about 15 times. Boxers are the classic example. Just had that case of the guy, his wife killed him in I forget what city it was, but a couple of boxers. One committed suicide. The other one is, I guess, his wife was arrested. Mm-hmm. So there's a volatility in and around and almost kind of permeating the lives of athletes. From the get-go, and dealing with pain and dealing with suffering and dealing with adversity becomes sort of core to who they are as human beings. And I just, as a sports psychologist, as we kind of wrap up here, what do you think is the most common misconception from the athlete's perception of sports psychology and the public?
The athlete oftentimes thinks that we're going to get in and do all kinds of not all the time, but they might think it's going to be scary because we're going to dig into their deep past problems and it's going to cause more problems than there is. That's not the case. We're trying to help them live more comfortable, more effective, more successful lives.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of a misperception about that. I mean, you're not going to get worse if you come see a professional. You're going to feel better. You're going to be feeling better about yourself. The misperception from coaches also, you said public, I guess you wanted to
public. Yeah, include the coaches, sure.
The public just doesn't know about it. The public, when I talk to people out on the streets or in a coffee shop, they go, oh, what is that for? So you're keeping those crazy athletes' heads straight or whatever. They don't understand the depth and the breadth of this profession. It's a real profession. It takes years and years and years of training, and just like any profession, it's out there to help people and help
would you
them.
Call it a, would you call it a specialty within psychology, or would you call it a completely different field from mainstream psychology?
Good question. I think it's a specialty within psychology and sports sciences. It's a combination.
Mm-hmm.
It's a profession that kind of merges the two, merges all of what we know about kinesiology, biomechanics, motor learning, motor control, and all those physiology fields with all we know about clinical psychology, applying psychological knowledge to the betterment of people. So it's a really cool field. I love it. There's so few people into it. That's the problem is that there's not a lot of voices out there like me trying to shout out about how beneficial it can be. There's not that many professionals doing it, and most people are one or the other. Most people are sports scientists living in a university environment, working within that context, trying to publish or perish. Or working with students.
Yeah.
Then you have the other group of clinical psychologists that read Sports Illustrated, but they don't have any essential training in. You know what I mean? So I'm trying.
I can relate. Yeah.
So there's few people that have really combined the two. I'm not trying to sound elitist, but there's a handful. There's really a handful in this country. But yet the big kicker is that I'm not getting calls from Major League Baseball, NFL, NHL. I mean, my phone's not ringing off the hook. What's that all about? So obviously it's a meritocracy. It's not a meritocracy. It's an old boys network still. And that's what I'm angry about. Not angry, but that's what I'm loud about, is that coaches need to wake up and smell the coffee and realize that there's some good people out there. I'm not trying to promote myself, but in some ways I am. It's like I want them to know that the professional standards can be looked at too as a very good source of help.
Well, if you think you're in a poorly lit field, try standing in the somatics field. That's a briar patch compared to what you're doing, and to try to get people to understand how you're dealing with memory, you're dealing with sorting behaviors, and you're dealing with tension that's not conscious and rhythms and all kinds of tissue kinetics. So, I can relate to the...
Everybody's got everybody's got their thing they're trying to market. But it's fascinating.
You've got to leg up, because you actually have a language about it that isn't elitist, that is inviting, it is inclusive. And to me, again, sports as a lifestyle is competition as a lifestyle is something that is inherent in the culture. So even if you're not a professional athlete, You can put the hand on the elephant of sports psychology, and you can gain something from it. Maybe it's just to teach your kid sportsmanship, maybe just to teach your kid the value of being a teammate or something like that, and leadership and all that stuff. And to me, that's much more like all the soccer field stuff that I do around here. It's much much more about dealing with the relationship between the kids and dealing with being able, because soccer is the ultimate team sport as far as with the youth sports around here. And dealing with the soccer moms and all the things, because it's different in the Little League. It's different than some of the other sports. It's much, much more of a community thing. There's no perception of professional future. It's sort of like where women's basketball was, 20 years ago, where it's just that's something that the girls do to pass the time. But it had that sense of yeah, right, exactly. Now forget it. What we're dealing with now with soccer is that, to me, this is a brain organizing sport. This is a way to get coordination skills. It's going to affect them in every other area of their life. So to take that, the drills that they do and make them into activities of daily living, make them use their non-dominant hand, you know, when they're putting the toys away, things like that, make them use both sides of their body because it's going to help them in the classroom when they sit on different sides of a classroom. Mm. All of those, like you said before, it's a lot about attention. It's a lot about focus. Mm. And you can't yell focus at them because that's a distraction. They have to experience it and immerse themselves in it and make it something that's a bottom-up, you know, from the gut to the brain type of a thing. And I think you've really established that with what you're talking about, with the way these athletes have to live their lives in that crucible and sort of, you know, be able to withstand that pressure coming from at them, you know, from every angle. And to have a sports psychologist be part of the resources that these guys have, not just when they get to be professionals and they're already up there and they can do the LeBron James and pick and choose, but, you know, he's a guy out of high school. He's been basically... you know, having the finger on the pulse for a long time here. So I hope that you get more active with these families like that and make it something they can get their hands on.
You're right. I think part of our talk today, we're so fascinated by the elite athlete. We're focused on the tip of the iceberg when in fact there's people in, you know, community youth sports that could benefit from this. The problem is there's not a lot of money for that, and there's not a lot of public funding to help enhance the experience. I think it would be a great thing. But typically what happens is you get you do professional work where they can afford your services. And so I do give a lot of free talks, and I do a lot of work, you know, try to do as much as I can in the community to help, but you also have to pay the bills, so it's difficult. But these are definitely skills that can be applied to everything in life, and you can learn so much from sports. And I think that's the real benefit from, you know, youth sports is to learn about sportsmanship, to learn about competition, to learn about setting goals effectively and being focused. And there's a lot of benefits from sport that go way beyond trying to become the next A-Rod.
Yeah, and again, is anyone really aspiring to be him at this point? You know, or are we on to Pujols until he falls? You know?
Yeah. Again, we put these heroes up only to trash them, you know, like we
did
with Dexter.
Exactly. And then if you're Brett Favre, you're going to keep picking up that stone until somebody won't let you play.
If he wants to, that's good for him. That's the way
I think so, too. I that's one of the things that I get into a lot with Mike Silver on his show, is that we've completely separated professional sports from prize sports or spectacle sports,
right,
where they're playing basically for a contract, for statistics, for money, for reward, and professionals are basically playing it because of their elite level first, and then they go pursue the prize. And Brett, to me, the reason why he wants to compete in the NFL is because he still wants to win. He still enjoys playing, and he doesn't need the money. Maybe if it's just his ego and all that stuff. To me, I'd rather have 20 Brett Favres out there trying to play at that elite level at their best than a bunch of loafers that are out there just getting a contract and taking up space. So I just think, you know, especially as all these sports become more multicultural and more international, especially hockey and, you know, basketball now with all the Europeans pouring in and baseball is becoming much more international, Japanese and Latin American players coming in. So you've got cultural differences. You've got all kinds of societal issues coming in from different angles. So you as a sports psychologist can, as Vince Scully would say, pull up a chair because you're going to have your pick of the litter here for the next little while here helping these guys through. So appreciate you.
Yeah, no, I sorry to cut you off there.
I was just congratulating you on putting up with me for an hour. So.
No, it's been great. No, I appreciate you speaking the truth and trying to get some of these coaches to come around to realizing that we're their best friends. I'm not there to change. The coach is the captain of the ship. They need to realize that, and that I'm a professional that can help them achieve their mission more effectively. That's all.
Well, hopefully we didn't offend Pete Carroll or Bill Parcells or any of
the
guys.
That's the name,
tonight.
Pete Carroll. How could we have forgotten his name? Pete Carroll.
Yeah.
That's
the Zen master of the gridiron as opposed to, you know, the basketball court out there in L.A. He's a great guy, and I have some friends that know him, and he's very into to the philosophy, the inner game, and quantum physics and a whole bunch of other fun stuff. So he's a great guy. So thanks for joining us here on Somatime, and hopefully we can get you back on here on a panel someday, and we can, you know, bang these things off at a couple different angles.
Sounds great, Mark. Thanks for having me on your show.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
All right, so there's another one. through the wickets, and John was good. He had a lot to say, and I hope you guys got a grip on this, because in somatics, if you're doing the math, you know, people talk about psychosomatic illness. So what's psychosomatic wellness? What's psychosomatic coherence? He was talking about that. He was talking about how we couple ourselves to our surroundings and all the issues that come up that affect our personality, that affect our way to perform, communicate to ourselves and other people. So he covered the whole elephant there, and it was amazing, actually. And look at that. The guy that was listening, as soon as John hung up, so did he. So there you go. We proved that he was a fan of John, not me. Bastard. So anyway.
You filthy criminals.
There you go, on the way out the door. So that wraps up the show for another week. Next week we're going to have on some people talking about heart gazing. Oofa. It deals with eye contact and the interaction of two beings. So we're going to get a little woo here in the heat of the summer and get into that a little bit, and hopefully we'll have some other twists of the tale as we go through. We're going to try and get a musical band on talking about entrainment. Their name is Entrain. We're pursuing them, and wow, got some authors coming on in August, and I don't know. I don't know what comes next. But anyway, back to Billy. And we will be back again next week at 9 o'clock. Anybody has any questions, comments, infiltrations, apples to bake, or whatever you want, send it to me at nakedsoma@gmail.com. And thank you once again for joining us. In this time, in your space, and all that stuff. So be yourselves out there and be well. We'll see you again next week at 9 o'clock here on Zomatide. Travel Light. Comments!